Welcome, and thank you for listening to the Jizo An Zen Community's Dharma Talks. We are happy to make these recordings available to you. Please consider making a one-time or recurring donation via the link on our webpage found under Become a Member. We thank you wholeheartedly. Gassho.
So tonight's talk is called War, Wisdom, and Compassion. And I'd like to start out with a quote. I have found that life persists in the midst of destruction, and therefore there must be a higher law than that of destruction. Only under that law would a well-ordered society be intelligible and life worth living. And if that is the law of life, we have to work it out in daily life. Wherever you are confronted with an opponent, conquer him with love. In a crude manner, I have worked it out in my life. That does not mean that all of my difficulties are solved. I have found, however, that this law of love has answered, as the law of destruction has never done. And that's from a piece called My Faith in Nonviolence by Mahatma Gandhi. Last week, it was 50 years since the fall of Saigon, the moment that ended the Vietnam War. The fall of Saigon on April 30th, 1975, signaled the end of South Vietnam. In the chaos leading up to that day, hundreds of thousands fled, many by sea in search of safety and a future. The total loss of human life from the war is staggering. It's estimated that the war resulted in the deaths of 2 to 3 million people, and this includes 1.2 million civilian casualties and a civilian death toll of 195,000 people. The Vietnam Veterans Memorial in Washington, D.C. lists more than 58,300 men and women of the U.S. Armed Forces who were killed or went missing. For those of us serving in the military during the Vietnam War, the fall of Saigon was a bittersweet event. The images of people storming the U.S. Embassy to seek shelter and helicopters airlifting civilians from the embassy roof are etched in my memory. The fall of Saigon marked the official end of a war that started with U.S. involvement in 1995, a war that essentially divided a nation. The war was finally over. But as a nation, we were left asking ourselves the question, was it worth it? What do we have to show for all of this suffering? Suffering that continues today as trauma in the children, now adults, of those lost parents and other family members to the war. This includes both sides of the war, North and South. The 50-year anniversary of the fall of Saigon is a good time to look back and reflect on the human cost of war. Not just the Vietnam War, all wars. Since the fall of Saigon, there have been other wars as well, and conflicts, Iraq, Afghanistan, Bosnia, and now Ukraine. So tonight, what I'd like to do is try to keep my comments to a minimum. Instead, share excerpts of articles and commentary related to the human cost of war. Thich Nhat Hanh, the Vietnamese Zen master who had to flee his country during the war, was focused not on politics, but on war-caused suffering. Suffering that he experienced firsthand, including a number of attempts on his life. And this is what he said. The fact that war kills far more innocent peasants than it does Viet Cong, it is a tragic reality of the life in the Vietnamese countryside. Those who escape death by bombing are forced to abandon their destroyed villages and seek shelter in refugee camps where life is even more miserable than it was in the villages. In a 1995 interview with Tricycle Magazine, he summed it up this way. You cannot disassociate yourself from a society that suffers. You have to be engaged and do whatever you can in order to help. Thich Nhat Hanh's engaged Buddhism led to a movement of religious renewal that linked insights gained from Buddhist teachings to hands-on engagement in situations of suffering from war and injustice. In an article called War and the Soul by Dr. Edward Tisch, a psychotherapist who specializes in treatment of veterans with post-traumatic stress syndrome, said there's a process to making war. And this is how he sums it up. In simple terms, the process of making war comprises two parts. First, we dehumanize the people involved, both our opposition and our own population. Then we place them and ourselves in a kill or be killed situation. In order to create soldiers willing to kill and a citizenry willing to tolerate it, we must first depersonalize and demoralize the other. To depersonalize portrays others as anonymous and less than human. To demoralize is to take the process a step further by making the other a carrier of evil, an incarnation of the devil. According to the Buddha, the mind is the source of all actions. It is most dangerous when we believe that our way is the only way for humankind. It is this way of thinking that drives leaders of nations to engage in war. If we see deeply into the fact that all beings are interconnected, we will stop blaming, arguing, and killing. To practice nonviolence, we first need to create true harmony within ourselves. Here is what Lao Tzu had to say with regard to creating harmony within ourselves. I have just three things to teach: simplicity, patience, compassion. These are your greatest treasures. Patience with both friends and enemies, you accord with the way things are. Patience with both friends and enemy, you accord with the way things are. Patience is one of the six paramitas. The paramitas are essentially six basic ways to go beyond the false security of our habitual patterns. The six paramitas are generosity, discipline, or sometimes the ethics, it's known as ethics, patience, enthusiastic perseverance, concentration, meditation, and wisdom. Each of the six paramitas is an enlightened quality of the heart, the seed of perfect realization within us all. The paramitas are the very essence of our true nature. In this way, the six paramitas are an inner cultivation, a daily practice for wise, compassionate, and enlightened living. Bringing these virtuous qualities into our true nature, into expression, requires discipline and practice. This is the path of the Bodhisattva, one who is dedicated to serving all living beings, human and non-human alike, with an awakened heart of skillful wisdom and all-embracing compassion. According to Thich Nhat Hanh, this enlightened quality of the heart is embedded in the paramita of patience as inclusiveness. Inclusiveness. Once we recognize the unnecessary pain that anger causes, we are already on the way to undermining its power. Patience as a discipline is unrivaled in neutralizing and preventing us from succumbing to anger and war. Through it, the suffering we endure from the heat of negative emotions is relieved. It is therefore of utmost importance that we resolve to practice patience, gaining inspiration through reflecting on its advantages and on the terrible effects of anger. In general, patience is motivated by our desire for inward and outward peace. Patience or inclusiveness is a key ingredient to nonviolence. This article that I'm going to read next, it's called War, What is War? The Zen Master and the Straw Mat. And this mat refers to a Goza mat. This is a Goza mat right here. It's flexible. It's not like a tatami. It has reeds in it. And you can see that it's uneven. It has wrinkles in it. And this article, again, What is War? The Zen Master and the Straw Mat, is by Lewis Richmond. He was a Buddhist priest, author, and disciple of Shunryu Suzuki. And here we go. One day, after a Saturday lecture, my Buddhist teacher, Shunryu Suzuki, opened the floor to questions. This was in 1968, at the height of the Vietnam War. I was in my early 20s at the time, working as an anti-war activist by day and learning about Buddhist meditation at Suzuki's temple on weekends. I raised my hand and asked the question that was troubling me and so many of us in the room. "Suzuki Roshi," I said, "what is war?" He pointed to the Goza mat in front of him, a 6 by 3 foot thin rush mat on which two people were seated, and said, "When two people sit down on one mat, each person smooths the wrinkles on his side of the mat. When the wrinkles meet in the middle, that's war." What a strange response was my first thought. Then I remembered that Suzuki had lived through World War II as a temple priest in Japan. Though he never talked about what he had experienced during the war, we all knew that it had been a traumatic and searing time for him. In any case, Suzuki's answers to my question had to be taken seriously. He knew far more about war than any of us young Americans did. At the time, his answer triggered a vigorous discussion in the whole group about the war in Vietnam and the fact that on this day, there was a big anti-war demonstration in the park. Many of us had been conflicted about whether to go to the demonstration or come to Suzuki's temple. Suzuki listened patiently to the back and forth of our discussion without saying anything. I'm sure that he appreciated our sincerity, but at the same time, given his own war experience, we probably struck him as young and naive. I've had decades since then to ponder his answer, and on deeper reflection, I have realized that the story has many nuances and implications. Clearly, the notion that each person wants their side of the mat to be smooth is an observation about a certain aspect of human nature. We tend to take care of our own needs first, or the needs of our family, community, or tribe, before we include the needs of anyone outside of those circles. Only an unusually perceptive and aware person would take into account the needs of others when it causes inconvenience or suffering to themselves or their own group. The highest moral stage is that in which a person's awareness of the common good is so broad and evolved that it includes sacrificing one's own well-being or even one's own life. This is the moral stance of such heroes as Mahatma Gandhi and Martin Luther King, as well as of Buddhism itself. Suzuki Roshi's comments about the wrinkles in the mat, I believe, emanated from that kind of Buddhist understanding. Given that understanding, it must have been horrific for Suzuki to watch helplessly as his entire country was swept up in a terrible war, which it lost at the cost of more than 2 million young men. I once saw a photograph of young Suzuki presiding over a ceremony at his temple to send the temple bell off to a factory to be melted down into bullets. He looked so sad in the photograph. I have often wondered how many funerals of young men Suzuki presided over during those war years. Assuredly, there were many. In today's world, one war that we are all facing is an eternal war. Some call it a cold civil war between political factions, red and blue, right and left. His answer might apply to that war too. There are so many ways in which Suzuki Roshi could have responded to my question. So many philosophical or religious doctrines that might have framed and explained the subject of war. But he did not do that. Instead, he just pointed to what was right in front of him, two people sitting on a straw mat. His answer taught us that war was not just some vast, abstract governmental action happening out there in the world against which we had to demonstrate and protest. The real war starts right here, within each of us. And the first challenge is to face the conflict that lives within our own hearts. He didn't directly say whether we should have gone to the anti-war demonstration or come to his temple for meditation, but his response to that was implicit in the answer he did give. If you want to truly know what war is, he was saying, sit down on a straw mat with one other person and don't try to smooth out just your side. Be willing to accept the wrinkles that are always there for everyone. Thich Nhat Hanh, in his book, For the Future to Be Possible, Buddhist Ethics for Everyday Life, he translates the first five precepts for modern time. The precepts are upaya, or skillful ways of living for people who embrace and live by them. The first precept, or vow, deals with killing. And here is how he interprets this precept. Aware of the suffering caused by the destruction of life, I am committed to cultivating compassion and learning ways to protect the lives of people, animals, and plants. I am determined not to kill, not to let others kill, and not to support any act of killing in the world, in my thinking, and in my way of life. According to him, we cannot support any act of killing. No killing can be justified. But not to kill is not enough. We must also learn ways to prevent others from killing. We cannot say, I am not responsible. They did it. My hands are clean. If you were in Vietnam during the time of the war, you cannot say, the Viet Cong did it. I did not. If you did not say or do anything to try to stop the killing, you were not practicing this precept, according to him. Even if what you said or did failed to stop the killing, what is important is that you tried using your insight and compassion. In other words, we need to get to the root cause of the suffering if we are to change things and reduce the potential for war. In addition, it's not just by not killing with our hands that you observe this precept. If in our thinking we allow the killing to go on, we also break this precept. We must be determined not to condone killing, even in our minds. All actions start with the mind. Without a correct understanding of a situation or person, our thoughts can be misleading and create confusion, despair, anger, or hatred. It essentially comes down to right view, the very first item of the Noble Eightfold Path. Here's an article by a veteran and Zen priest. The Koan of War. The veteran sews a raksu from camouflage material to honor those who wore the uniform. This is by Hobie Coban Regan. This is from Tricycle. It's an article of 2023. In our lineage, we don't make a lot of fuss over the color of one's raksu, a garment woven of different pieces of fabric that represents the robe worn by the Buddha. But when I decided to depart from the tradition and sew a raksu cut out of camouflage, I knew I needed to have a good reason. Like other young men, I stumbled into death dealing because of poverty, misplaced patriotism, and predatory recruitment practices. It took decades to find my way. I joined the Marine Corps in 1987 and became an amphibious assault crew chief. It was strange for me at 21 to be in charge of an amphibious tank. Stranger still to be leading others, to be responsible for their lives. I wasn't afraid of dying. I was afraid of seeing any of my team members suffer because of my error. During my tour, the Soviet Union collapsed, and we had new sworn enemies in the Middle East with Operations Desert Storm and Desert Shield. I didn't understand these people or their culture. I didn't understand why we were fighting them. So I joined a mosque to see what they were all about. Joining the mosque allowed me to see the war from another perspective and was very helpful for me. I needed to try to understand war. I spent the 90s going to college and working civilian things, civilized things. When I met people, I pretended I was just like them, not a death dealer haunted by nightmares. Then 9/11 came and pulled me back into the fray. I had left the Marine Corps after a single tour, but because of my service and my mapping expertise, I was recruited by various military and intelligence agencies to find and capture them or kill them. A lot of my friends and coworkers were killed or maimed during this time. Those who survived had nightmare memories, and many self-medicated or committed suicide. I was not immune. I became angry, violent. One day, during an intense confrontation, I almost killed two of my own officers. I knew I had to do something to fix myself. I started to practice Zen. I intended to practice Zen for a few months, long enough to gain the skills to mitigate my anger. That was in 2008. I am still practicing and today serve as an ordained priest. I have worked my way out of war. I am no longer recruited by the agencies of death. I work with those agencies, though, with soldiers and prisoners and police officers to help them with their trauma, their memories, their anger and suffering. In other words, with the war and strife all around us. One evening, I spent a long time online with a friend, trying to talk him out of self-destruction. The next day, his family told me that they found him inside his cabin with a portable generator out of gas, with the words, "No code," written on his chest with a Sharpie. As part of my own healing practice, I began to conduct funeral ceremonies. Many of those were veterans, largely suicides. During the funeral of one of my members' friends, I got an idea. I would sew a raksu from the uniforms of the people I had served with to honor them, but even more to defy the reign of death. Cutting, Measuring, sewing the cloth of a roxu is always a meditative act, a reflective act. But as I constructed this roxu out of cloth that men and women in uniform like me had worn, I was flooded with emotions. Catharsis is a purging of emotion that, like Zen, does not rely on words. I have sought to understand war, but war is a koan that cannot be understood, can be grasped only by those who have lived through it. I can hear it in the voices of my friends in the Ukraine and Russia and see it in their faces. Although it can't be understood or explained, it must be purged. Maybe this roxu, the robe of the Buddha, can stand for the purgation of suffering, replacing fear, anger, violence, and death with hope, wisdom, compassion, and peace of the Buddha. The last article I'd like to share is by someone that practices mindful meditation in Ukraine. And I shared a part of this article about a year and a half ago on a Tuesday night. So for some of you, it will sound familiar, but it's worth repeating. And this is the title: Practicing Peace in a Time of War. A mindfulness practitioner from Ukraine shares his experience of living in a war zone. It continues on. My wife and I spent 2021 setting up Life in Flow, our new center for mindfulness practices, retreats, and courses. Our dream was beginning to come true, but everything came to a screeching halt when the Russians invaded Ukraine in the early part of 2022. Russian troops attacked our village almost every day. We could hear the sound of cannons, and we had to run to the basement several times a day when the shelling of residential areas began. Each time we went outside was a risk, not knowing whether you would be exposed to another shelling or not. It felt like our country was drowning in an ocean of tears, hopelessness, powerlessness, and grief. Every day, new feeds overflowed with reports of new deaths and attacks by Russian troops. Entire cities were destroyed, and many settlements simply ceased to exist. War is like a strong headwind. The resistance you feel is quite palpable. Every step requires effort. My family and I would sleep in the basement every night to hide from the nighttime shelling. This was a period of tectonic shifts in my inner world. It was very difficult to resist the total depression to which my consciousness was drawn. Meditation literally saved me. I was able to pull myself out of a state of confusion, weakness, and despondency for a while with the help of my practice. Every time I did a meditation session, I managed to create a small temporary island of light and peace amid the ocean of tears. I began to panic less, to feel less anger, and less depressed. I could feel how my mental state was affecting those around me, particularly my wife and daughter. As I gained confidence and peace, so did they. Since the war began, we seem to have found ourselves in a special dimension. Before the war, it was just the news that you sometimes watched at lunch or before going to bed. It was all happening somewhere far away. The reality is that we live in an era of stories and novels, movies and TV shows, and we hardly distinguish reality from fantasy. I clearly remember the feeling when we were sitting in the basement, one-ton rockets exploding all around us. And I simply could not believe that this was happening to us for real. But the primal fear arising reminded me every time that this was not a dream. This was reality. This experience made me look anew at my own and other people's problems. We all live in the same house called Earth. And when there's a fire in the next room and we do nothing, it's only a matter of time before the fire in our room starts. When I began to come into contact with the problems of other people during the war, my natural desire to help others greatly expanded my focus, and it gave me strength and energy in my work. My wife and I gradually became involved with a project we called Compassion and Wisdom in Ukraine that sought to provide psychological help and support to Ukrainians in group and individual sessions. Together with some friends, we created a meditation course titled Self-Help and Mutual Assistance as a Way Out of Critical States. And to this day, we work with Ukrainians facing difficulties. When I'm able to help someone, I feel a healing sense of gratitude that this opportunity has opened up to me. I have become even more convinced that the world as a whole is a much better place than it was 100, 200, 500, or 1,000 years ago. Despite the war in our country, I see that there are very few countries like Russia left, countries that want to destroy their neighbors to take over their territories. My impression is that the help and support that the whole world gives us shows that humanity in general is becoming wiser and more humanistic. So I join those people who make the world a better and wiser place, and I commit myself to making sure that the knowledge I gain will benefit the people around me. The Bodhisattva ideal being practiced in the Ukraine. So in closing, the 50-year anniversary of the fall of Saigon is a good time to look back and reflect on the human cost of war, not just the Vietnam War, all wars. There really are no winners in a war. The human suffering outweighs any lands that were conquered or any new ideology imposed on those conquered. When we look deeply into the situation of those on the other side, we see that they are just like us. They also want only to have a place where they can live in safety and peace. The challenge, of course, is to convince our elected officials of this reality, since they are the ones that can lead us into war or keep us out of wars. So the question of the night is, our first grave precept is do not kill, affirm life. And this is was stated in Thich Nhat Hanh's piece on this particular precept, but he did it in a narrative way. Our precept, it's in the background more. So how do we affirm life when we see that we may be heading towards war, or we're in a war to help get us out of it? So how do we affirm life in that particular situation? That's the question of the night. How do we make it tangible, not just theoretical? Affirm life. What does that mean?